Welcome to Inside Politics. I'm Dana Bash. Jury selection is nearly complete in the case of the people of the state of New York versus Donald J. Trump. 12 jurors and one alternate have been sworn in. Right now, Judge Juan Merchan and lawyers from both sides are trying to fill out the panel with five more alternates. Trump is inside the room, and we're told that he's been looking right at jurors as they answer questions and whispering with his attorney. Now, if you were wondering about his mood on the way in, roll the tape.
This is a rigged drive. It's coming from the White House. New York is going down as a very corrupt place to do business, that I can tell you. A lot of people are not going to be moving to New York. This will go on for another 4 or 5 weeks, and it's very unfair. And people know it's very unfair. I have to be released of a gag order. They've taken away my constitutional rights to speak, and that includes speaking to you. I have a lot to say to you, and I'm not allowed to say it.
Okay, again, there's no evidence that this is coming from the White House, and what you just heard was him speaking. He's just limited in the things that he can say about the judge and the judge's family because of things that he has said on social media. Now, going back to what's happening right now, if the jury selection situation wraps up today, opening statements are expected on Monday. It will be a trial, the likes of which this country has never seen before. CNN's chief legal analyst, Laura Coates, is still live in front of the Manhattan courthouse. Laura, what's happening right now?
What a day this has been. We are that much closer to getting the 18 jurors that are needed. That's the 12 plus the six alternates, who those alternates, by the way, might very well be needed over the course of the next several weeks as this trial goes on. We know now that the questioning will be the same for the alternates. They have the same standards they must meet as being not only qualified to be on the jury, they'll have the same questioning, the same voir dire, lots of details about whether they could truly be impartial. We're hearing a lot of questions from the prosecution and, of course, then the defense on this issue. They'll have about 25 minutes per total to talk to the entire jury pool of alternates who will also be seated. The jury alternates, they are aware likely that they in fact will be alternates, but they will have the same requirement to be attentive and to listen because they might have to assume the role of one of the deliberating jurors at the end of the conclusion of this trial. We know that if this wraps up this morning, later on today, they'll have the examination of what's known as a Sandoval hearing, a phrase you're going to hear a lot. That's just lawyers speak for, I want to give the defendant notice of what might come up should he choose to testify. They laid out a number of categories that might be included in that realm, and so he'll have that hearing later on today with an eye towards not only potentially opening statements on Monday, but also the gag order hearing that has not been resolved yet that will happen on Tuesday. I want to bring in right now, though, Kristen Holmes, who's got some breaking news for us about what at least one juror is saying about the pressure. Kristen, what are we hearing?
Yeah, this is really fascinating because it goes to show you just how intense this process is for some of these people. They believe that they could be fair and impartial. They believe they could sit on this jury. They have sat through rounds of questioning. And now we have one juror who is waiting to see if they would become an alternate. And this is in the basically the prosecution is now doing their questioning, the 30 minutes of questioning. She began crying when she was handed the microphone during the questioning and said, I'm sorry, I thought I could do this. I wouldn't want someone who feels this way to judge my case either. They went on to say, I don't want to feel like I've wasted someone's time. This is just so much more stressful than I thought it would be. And this is really indicative of what we are seeing here and just how high profile this case is and what it means to some of these jurors to be sitting in the room with Donald Trump, a former president. We know that he is sitting there. Yes, he is looking at some of the jurors, but at times he's going through paperwork. At times he's leaning back in his chair. But we've heard from a lot of these jurors that have been dismissed, who have then later talked about their experience, was just how shocking it was to be that close to him. And also the pressure of understanding that this is going to be covered by the media so closely, that understanding who this defendant is, what this could mean moving forward. And so this just gives you a real embodiment of why these alternates are so important. Yes, she hadn't been chosen to be an alternate yet, but you can see we're not even at the beginning stages. She had gone through several different iterations, been asked multiple times if she could be fair and impartial, and essentially broke during this questioning because it is so stressful. And that is something that could happen again to various jurors as we move forward.
I mean, the elephant in the room truly here, Dana, is the fact that you've got a presidential candidate. The fact that a prosecutor talked about this not being about Trump being a former president, not being about being a candidate for the presidency. It's not about popularity. It's not about who you're going to vote for. They said it's about whether the evidence proves he's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt with the crimes he's been charged with. This is a fascinating morning, Dana.
It sure is. Wow, what a scene that Kristen just described. Let's talk more about this with Carolyn Cook. She is a lawyer and jury consultant, also our very own chief legal correspondent, Paula Reed. Thanks so much, both of you. I want to start with you. I mean, you have been through many, many scenarios where you have jury selection going on. Nothing, of course, quite like what we're seeing now with the former president, who, by all accounts, is staring right at the jurors and the potential jurors, which I'm sure is something that they have not witnessed before and certainly they have not felt before. This particular potential alternate crying, saying that she thought she would be okay and she doesn't think she can be impartial.
Yeah, well, you know, the great thing about the jury system is it works, and that's a perfect example of somebody who is taking her duty seriously, giving it a lot of thought, and wanting to be a fair person and being honest about the fact that she can't handle it. And that's what, I mean, honestly, I've seen so many different situations with lay people approaching important cases. They're up to the task of standing up to big corporations, standing up to the government. They do the right thing. And so I think it's encouraging. It should be encouraging to the defense and to the government to see jurors feeling that they can admit when they can't do it.
And others, of course, saying that they can do it and they feel that they can be impartial.
Yeah, absolutely. This has moved a lot faster than a lot of experts and even members of both sides of the two teams expected. We are on track, as the judge expected, to begin on Monday. And there were some folks who were suggesting that this could potentially take weeks. So it does appear that they have been able to, for now, seat a jury. Now they just got to seat these alternates.
Let me take a broader look at what this jury looks like so far. And we're just going to talk generally about their jobs.
Right.
Salesperson, investment banker, corporate lawyer, security engineer, English teacher, software engineer, civil litigator, retired wealth manager, speech therapist, physical therapist. First thing I'm thinking is this is very Manhattan.
Very educated.
Which is what you want. You want a jury to represent the people and the place in which this trial is happening.
Well, yes, in theory. I mean, that's the way the rules apply. But I don't think that's what the defense wants. And, you know, it's just interesting because the prosecutor is saying to the jury pool when he has his time to do the questions, he's actually really just lecturing them, which is really not voir dire. He's telling them what to think. This is not about politics. This is not about who you're going to vote for. Well, it really is, and the jurors know that. That's why they're brave. That's why people are saying, I can't do this, because they know it's bigger than just what's in front of them. And so I just think that having a balance of power is important, and that even though this jury is representative of Manhattan, it's not really representative of the rest of the country. However, I think it's a good cross-section, and from Trump's perspective, I think I would be okay with who those people are.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you said that, because that is when you talked about it not necessarily being something that the defense is quite happy with. And that, of course, has been one of Trump's arguments going into this, and his lawyers as well, that it's Manhattan. I'm never going to get a fair trial. It's Manhattan, of course, is not the most conservative island in the world. Then I just want to dig deep specifically on one of the jurors, Paula, juror 11. She is somebody that Trump's legal team wanted out. She's not married, doesn't have kids, works for a multinational apparel company, does not like Donald Trump's, quote, persona, only reads headlines in industry specific publications. What are you hearing from the Trump team?
So they clearly tried to remove this person. The judge rejected that on the law. She said she could be impartial, so the judge is correct. But it was a little surprising. I've talked to some sources that she was not removed because this does open an avenue of attack for the former president. He has to be careful because this is a juror, but this is certainly something that they're going to bring up on appeal. They are reserving every single issue. This issue of can they get a fair jury, right? They fought to get that specific number of how many people said at the outset, I can't even be impartial, I gotta go, right? Because they wanted to show how difficult it is in this venue. Then you see someone like this getting on the jury after she called him selfish and I believe self-serving, mm-hmm. you know, the graphic up. But that did surprise me that the judge let her stay, even though you know that this is gonna be an issue not only in the court of public opinion, but in a possible appeal if there's a conviction.
Let's put that up. He just seems very selfish and self-serving, so I don't really appreciate that in any public servant. So I don't know him as a person, so I don't know how he is in terms of his integrity. It's just not my cup of tea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an awkward position to be in when you're the defendant and you're being forced to either use a strike. And was that when they ran out of strikes?
I believe so, because it was very close to the end and they were trying to remove her for cause.
Yeah.
I believe so, but it was very chaotic. That's all happened really quickly, but I think that was part of the issue.
And if I were in that situation and I had, you know, two strikes left, I'm like saving my strikes for the worst of the worst. And that's a big disadvantage, the way they did this jury selection, because you can't see all the dented apples at once. So you don't know if tomorrow is going to be worse than today. I would probably live with her too, because he isn't people's cup of tea. He knows that, and he's not trying to curry favor with anyone. I mean, that's sort of his, you'd think he would behave a little bit more with a judge, but he doesn't because he is who he is.
Well, on that note, Paul, I got to ask you about the fact that the assistant district attorney, Josh Steinglass, is saying that he is not going to let the defense know ahead of time which witnesses are going to be brought once the trial starts. Presumably that will happen next week. And when Todd Blanche, who is Trump's lawyer, proposed that he would assure the district attorney's office that Trump would not post about the witnesses if they shared their witness list, the judge responded, I don't think you can make that representation.
Mm-hmm. So there the judge is not only saying, no, I'm not going to force them to give you the witnesses, but also I don't think you have control over your client. So not great for the defense team there. But these are the legal consequences of these political attacks, right? If you are not abiding by the gag order, the district attorney's office says, look, we're not gonna extend the courtesy that we normally would to give you these witnesses. And this is something that I'm sure is very frustrating to the Trump lawyers, because they would love to know who is coming down the pipe so that they can adequately prepare. But the district attorney's office, clearly that is an argument. Mm-hmm. That is a fear that is well-founded. The judge agreed.
And I should say, first of all, thank you both. I should say that there will be a hearing on the gag order that is in place, that the former president is maybe haunting a little bit. That's going to happen next week. Mm-hmm. Thanks so much for your expertise. Always good to see you, Paula. And coming up, is this it? New images exclusive to CNN show the aftermath of Israel's retaliation inside Iran. The question hanging over the entire world now, will Iran ratchet up already sky-high tensions in the Middle East? Stay with us.
The assignment with me, Audie Cornish.
So there have been arrests, suspensions, disciplinary hearings. They're shutting down graduation events.
At this moment, the part of the protests that are admirable are young people calling attention to atrocities.
Michael Roth is the president of Wesleyan University.
I would like to make a space for them to do that, as long as that space doesn't prevent other people from pursuing their education.
Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Right now, tortured uncertainty about what happens next in the Middle East. A U.S. official confirms to CNN that Israel struck inside Iran. It's a daring move, and the question now is whether this back and forth will continue or even escalate into an all-consuming regional war, or the fairly limited nature of the response may have found a Goldilocks way through the trickiest of crises that we have seen in the region in years. The strike happened here near Isfahan, and that is a military base. U.S. officials tell CNN the target was non-nuclear. The U.S. was told ahead of time, but a senior official says the Biden administration did not bless the strike. Let's get straight to CNN's Jeremy Diamond, who is in Israel. Jeremy, what are you hearing from sources inside the Netanyahu government?
Well, Dana, the Netanyahu government, as well as the Israeli military, are completely silent on these overnight strikes, and that is very much intentional. As we've been talking over the course of the last week about the ways in which the Israeli government might be able to thread the needle here, both ensure that that attack by Iran over the weekend, the first in its of its kind on Israeli soil, would not go unanswered, but also at the same time trying to avoid escalating this conflict between Israel and Iran into a full-blown war. And it appears here that they have actually managed to thread that needle, and the lack of public fanfare around this is very much a part of achieving that goal. We have heard from the Iranians last night, hours before this strike actually took place. They had indicated that an Israeli attack on Iranian soil would result in an immediate and overwhelming response by Iran targeting Israel. And so far, that hasn't happened. And in fact, a regional source, intelligence source, has told us that there is no indication now that that tit-for-tat between Iran and Israel is going to continue, suggesting that Israel may have achieved the right balance here in terms of sending the message that it felt it needed to send while avoiding further escalation here. Now, in terms of the United States, what we are hearing from them is a continued focus on not on what happened overnight from Israel, but rather on Iran's attack over the weekend. And that was also a goal of this Israeli response, was that to ensure that any Israeli response wouldn't detract from what has begun to happen over the course of the last few days. And that is a growing international coalition forming once again to isolate Iran, to hold Iran accountable, as the Secretary of State, Tony Blinken, said today. And that is also very much something that Benjamin Netanyahu would like to see continue. And in this way, it seems like it will be able to continue. Dana.
Oh, such great reporting. So many layers of important nuance there, Jeremy. Thank you so much. Here to continue talking about this moment and the consequences, CNN military analyst, retired Major General Spider Marks, and founding partner and Washington correspondent for PUC News, Julia Yaffe. Thank you so much for being here, both of you. General Marks, I will start with you. Talk about what we saw overnight from a military perspective.
Well, this was an attack by Israel very clearly against a military target. So I think the definition of proportionality is at play here. I think it works. Israel went after the delivery capabilities that the Iranians used last Saturday night. This was an attack against missile production, missile capability. It was an airbase. It's got military ground capability. And it was not, as reported, an attack against Isfahan nuclear enrichment capability and research and development capability. Really, this is all about deterrence, and deterrence is all about trying to convince a potential adversary or an aggressor that there's a better alternative than going to war. And in the case of what took place last Saturday, Israel demonstrated deterrence. The Iranians failed dramatically. I think it's fair to say that it was feckless. It fell on its face. It did nothing that Iran was hoping it might do. On the other hand, Israel has now responded to Iran, and does Iran feel like it has achieved a level of deterrence? So this is where we are right now about what's going to take place in terms of next steps.
And Julia, talk about the sound of silence from both the Biden administration and Jeremy's reporting, largely from the Netanyahu government. We'll put Ben-Gvir aside for a second, who is very right wing and called it lame or something to that extent. But just picking up on the deterrence idea that General Marks talked about, the intentional, quiet response from the Biden administration in particular. What does that tell you?
Well, it tells me that the two allies, Israel and U.S., have different objectives and different interests here. For the Biden administration, it was very clear to signal very loudly, which it did through various leaks to the press, that it was not interested in this becoming a wider regional war, that it did not want Israel to retaliate, and that it did not back Israel's retaliation against Iran, nor did it, guarantee Israel its help if Israel went further in this, right? So kind of distancing itself. Israel felt it had an interest in providing some kind of deterrence. Again, this was an unprecedented attack on Israeli soil, which itself was an a response to an unprecedented attack by Israel on a diplomatic facility, whether or not the shingle had been hung up 2 weeks before or not. Under the Vienna Convention, it's still considered sovereign Iranian territory. So Israel felt it had to respond somehow, but also calibrate its response in a way that wouldn't alienate the U.S. Much more than it already has in the last 6 months. So again, you're seeing, you know, allies don't always have total overlap in terms of their interests and their priorities.
And General, I want to read you a quote from Seema Shine, former Mossad head of research. This is a quote given to the New York Times today. The way they present it to their own people, this is speaking about Iran, and the fact that the skies are open already allows them to decide not to respond. Can you kind of take it from there and explain what that means with regard to the positioning and posturing that we're seeing now?
Yeah, I think what it says is that Iran understands that Israel's got an incredible capability militarily. They are comfortable operating on multiple lines of effort, right? You got stuff going on in Gaza. Hezbollah is routinely there. Israel has some internal political things they have to deal with. And now they can conduct a strike. And we haven't gotten into the details because we don't know the details of what this strike looks like. I mean, did an aircraft fast mover transit over Iraq? Did it make it without any kind of detection? I would assume it did, but we'll have to piece that together. So Iran understands that it is dealing with a very capable adversary in the form of the IDF. They're going to remain silent. What I would also say, if I can comment very briefly, is that I don't know this, but the U.S. silence indicates to me that they were apprised of what was going to take place. And that's why I think we saw the Secretary of State earlier today was very, very silent. He didn't answer any of those questions. And you have to assume United States understood, didn't approve, they weren't in the decision loop, but they understood what was going to take place, the limited nature of the attack.
Just real quick, I see you nodding your head, Julia.
Yeah, no, I agree with the Major General that the U.S., again, didn't approve, but was appraised. I think it would have been very much in Israel's interest to appraise Washington of what it was about to do. But to me, it's also very, you know, classically Iran. Think about what happened after the U.S. strike that assassinated General Qasem Soleimani, who was a much bigger deal than the two generals that were assassinated by Israel earlier this month, right? Is Iran talked a really big game about how this man had been martyred, about how it was going to retaliate. And in the end, it sent a dozen cruise missiles at a U.S. base in Iraq. Right. They mostly landed in open fields. They were, you know, and Iran said, okay, we're done retaliating. They talk a really big game, but they're not willing to escalate it to the point of a major war.
All right. Thank you so much, both of you, for your insight, your expertise, your reporting, all of it. I really appreciate it. And up next, a key foreign aid package advances with help from Democrats. But can House Speaker Mike Johnson hold on to his job? A key Republican congressman will be here next. Just within the last hour, the House voted in a bipartisan manner to advance a key foreign aid package, a major step towards sending support to Ukraine and Israel. It was a pretty extraordinary move. More Democrats supported that procedural measure than the Republicans did. Republicans, of course, are in control of the House of Representatives. It was 165 Democrats compared to 151 Republicans, and those Democratic votes were key for Speaker Mike Johnson overcoming opposition from his right flank. That reliance on the other side of the aisle means Johnson's future may be in jeopardy now. A third Republican said just moments ago that he supports ousting the speaker. I want to get straight to CNN's Melanie Zanona on Capitol Hill. Melanie. Melanie, can
Dana,
you hear me?
Dana, Yeah, there you go. Look, Speaker Mike Johnson's job is certainly at risk here. He is on very thin ice, but he knew heading into this day that putting these foreign aid bills on the floor and needing to rely on Democratic support to do so was going to spark an uproar on the right. But it is still a very rare moment here to see Democrats support these procedural votes. Just historically, they've always been done along party lines. And in this case, more Democrats actually supported this procedural vote than Republicans. I want to read you the vote breakdown because it's very interesting here. 165 Democrats supported that procedural vote and just 151 Republicans voted for it. Now, Johnson says he's not worried about his job being at risk here. And he also delivered a very forceful defense of this foreign aid package, which will receive a final vote tomorrow. Just take a listen.
It's not the legislation that we would write if Republicans were in charge of both the House, the Senate, and the White House. This is the best possible product that we can get under these circumstances to take care of these really important obligations. And so we look forward to the vote tomorrow. We look forward to every member voting their conscience and their desire. And that is exactly how this process is supposed to work and how the House is supposed to operate.
Now, Green has not taken steps yet to actually force a floor vote on the motion to vacate, and the House has adjourned for the day, so the earliest this could actually come is tomorrow. But given the fact that there are now three Republicans who have signed on to this resolution, that means Johnson is going to have to rely on Democrats in some way to bail him out. Now, Democrats have not made any commitments so far, but they have signaled some willingness to help Johnson keep the speakership, and a large part of that is because of the Republicans who are behind this effort to oust Johnson. Dana.
Melody, thank you so much for that reporting. Joining me here now is Republican Congressman Dusty Johnson of South Dakota, who came over after your vote. Thank you so much for being here, sir. What does it tell you that this is a procedural vote? And for, you know, those watching at home, they might not know that it's this kind of vote that is almost always strictly along party lines. You heard that the speaker argue, well, maybe that's not a bad thing, that this is how it's supposed to work. That's not how some in the right flank of your party see it. What does it say about Speaker Johnson's leadership right now?
I think it says a lot of positive things about Mike Johnson's leadership. If Mike Johnson just wanted to play the standard political games and be safe and make sure that everybody in our conference loved him, he would have played it safe. He wouldn't have been willing to cobble together this bipartisan strategy. But if you pull the lens out, if you pull the camera out, mm-hmm. What just happened? A group of bipartisan members came together and said, let's have a conversation about Israel. Let's have a conversation about Ukraine. Let's put these things on the floor tomorrow and let's have a vote. Isn't that how our system is supposed to work?
Yes, but bipartisan is a very dirty word for people like Marjorie Taylor Greene and now Paul Gosar and Congressman Massey, the three of whom are saying that they support the idea of kicking him out for the high crime of bipartisanship.
Listen, I don't have to be happy with reality, but I do have to accept the reality. If you're going to govern a country, you don't get to live in fantasy land. The Democrats are in control of the Senate. Republicans are in control of the House. That means under our constitutional system, it is literally true that no bill can ever become law unless you've got votes from both sides of the aisle. It's a pain in the butt. I get it. I just think it's time for the grown-ups, the big boys and the big girls, to figure out how to govern a country, and it's going to be messy sometimes.
I just want to read you a couple of quotes. A Democratic Congresswoman Grace Meng tweeted last night, Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries is essentially functioning as the real speaker already. Tom Massey, who I mentioned before. The U.S. House is now officially in an alternate universe where the speaker shares procedural power with the Democrats.
It is true that when Republicans are not united, when we don't have we don't have people backing the speaker's play, then you do give a certain amount of power over to the minority. It's amazing to me. I mean, I try to be a pretty good teammate. When you've got a quarterback in the huddle with the 11 football players, says, gang, it's going to be a running play. Now, it may be that somebody on the offensive line disagrees with that play call, but if you want to be successful as a team, you run the damn play. Not all 11 players get to call their own play. And now you could try it that way, but you're going to fail. And so that's the situation we're in right now. I wish people understood that we could get more conservative policy wins, which I desire if Republicans stuck together.
I want to play something that you told my colleague John Berman just days after the eight Republicans ousted Kevin McCarthy back in October.
If we don't change the foundational problems within our conference, it's just going to be the same stupid clown car with a different driver. Those hardliners, they're a real problem. And I don't think the pyromaniacs are going to be satisfied after they've burned down one house. I think they're going to have an itching to go burn down a couple more.
Is that what we're going to see tomorrow?
That guy sounded pretty smart. It was almost as though he foretold that this was going to happen.
Same clown car, different driver. Is that what's going to happen tomorrow?
Pyromaniacs who want to burn it down. This is what I said during the last speaker fight, that getting rid of Kevin McCarthy was not going to make America stronger. It hasn't. It wasn't going to deliver more conservative victories. It hasn't. And that, in fact, it was going to destabilize my party, destabilize the House, and hurt America. And that has all come to fruition. And now we've got people who want to run that same ridiculous, stupid play again. They can count me as a no.
Is Mike Johnson going to survive?
But Mike Johnson's going to survive.
How? With Democratic help?
Well, I think in the end, you're going to have a lot of very thoughtful members who understand that these silly D.C. Power games don't actually serve our national interest. We got to get a farm bill done. Clearly, we need to deal with the southern border. We've got a certain number of things that we have got to get done. I think there will be a few thoughtful folks on the other side of the aisle that understand that we should not be putting chaos over this R versus D battle.
Is your Republican majority in jeopardy because of all this chaos?
Oh, I still think the Democratic vision for this country is not selling all that well across America. Now, it would be better if Republicans, I think, spoke with one voice, if we were more coordinated, if we worked as a team. I still actually feel pretty good about Republican prospects in the House, and I think Republican takeover of the Senate is just about a Sherlock.
Before I let you go, your governor, mm-hmm. Republican Kristi Noem of South Dakota, she is talked about as a contender to be a running mate for Donald Trump. Should she be?
She is a heck of a leader. She knows who she is. She knows what she believes. And she doesn't cower from the challenge. I'm going to be honest, I'm kind of sick and tired of cowardly politicians. And so I'm kind of looking forward to somebody who's got a little swagger, who understands what American strength really looks like.
And that's her.
Oh, Kristi Noem would be great.
Okay. Thank you so much for coming in. Mm-hmm. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks much.
And coming up, we are going to go back to Manhattan to our team outside the courthouse there. History is being made. Laura Coates will join us to talk broadly about the incredible week that we saw in that courthouse. Stay with us.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Underway right now, more questions for prospective alternate jurors in the Trump hush money trial. Reporters inside the courtroom say Trump is watching intently, even as his lawyers ask the men and women who will decide his fate if they're bothered by allegations that Trump has been unfaithful in his marriage. That is a key piece of this case, as Trump stands accused of falsifying business records to hide an alleged affair with an adult film actress. CNN's chief legal analyst Laura Coates is live at the Manhattan courthouse still. So, Laura, since you and I spoke, I don't know, maybe 20 minutes ago, some interesting developments have occurred in this questioning of the potential alternate jurors. What's going on?
Well, this is the time to really lean in here. Those who are questioning these jurors want to get to the heart of the matter. What will be presented, whether it's about him being unfaithful, also about what they really think of him. You have a number of jurors who are saying that they are favorable towards him and they believe in his policies, that he's been good for the country. One juror saying that she takes more issue with Trump's base than she does with Donald Trump and has criticized them as well. Another person asking the jurors about his rhetoric and whether that has led them to be more biased towards him or otherwise. They seem to imply they could actually be very impartial towards him, causing causing Donald Trump, of course, to lean in intently about how they viewed him. And of course, the questions about unfaithfulness are really key part of this, of course, because part of the allegations stem around an accusation that he has been involved in an extramarital affair with Stormy Daniels. Now, that may or may not be crucial, the veracity of that, for proving the underlying charges here, which include falsification of business records, certainly to the rhetoric of that. Also, there's a moment here where a juror is asked about how they feel about the fact that it's Donald Trump in the courtroom. And the juror said, a male from New York said, "We don't really get starstruck or really care about anything like that. He's just a normal person. That's the way I see it." Another person talked about him as a businessman, that he is a family man as well. So a lot of how they're viewing him is really going to be intriguing for the defense and the prosecution as to who they want to ultimately sit as alternates. Now remember, these are alternates versus these primary jurors who will deliberate. But as you know, and the way the world turns, any one of them could be called to actually deliberate and decide the fate of Donald Trump.
That's right, which is why picking them is so important, and the process is not over. Thank you so much, Laura, all week. Absolutely terrific. Thanks for breaking it down. Up next, the former president is forced to sit quietly, judged, criticized by fellow Americans. CNN's political director David Chalian will join us for a look at the wild political moment that we're in. Well, what a week. Who better to talk about all of it, put it in context, than our very own political director David Chalian. Hello.
Hello.
Obviously, it's unprecedented that you have a former president, a presidential candidate, sitting in a courtroom, waiting to see who is going to decide his fate. But the other part of this is that it's Donald Trump. And Donald Trump is very much in a bubble of his own making. And it's not just because he's a former president. It's because he's, a wealthy guy who lives in Mar-a-Lago, who lives in his areas where he has people who are not necessarily critical of him, let's say it that way. And that's not what he's enduring process.
It's so true, Dana. It's got to be so just plainly uncomfortable for him. I know he complained that the room is freezing and that's uncomfortable. And the judge said today they're working on the temperature in the courtroom. But exactly to your point, I mean, any president or former president lives in a bubble.
Right.
That is true. But not every president has also been a CEO of a company and a billionaire living high in a New York City skyscraper for most of their lives on a top floor. It's like he has lived such a life in a bubble for so long. And to deal with this reality of people who are expressing, in some parts, very unfavorable opinions about him.
To his face.
Feet away from him, to his face, as he's watching and looking at them intently.
Let me read a couple of these quotes. I don't like his persona. He just seems very selfish and self-serving. By the way, this person is now juror number 11. Mm-hmm. There have been behaviors that I haven't approved of President Trump towards females. Sometimes the way he may carry himself in public leaves something to be desired. Now, it's not as if he doesn't hear this stuff when he watches television and he's a vigorous, voracious consumer of media, but it is different when in person. But beyond that, David, talk about the moment that we're in political history.
Yeah, so when you look at, as you said, an unprecedented factor right now. We've never had a former president sitting as a defendant in a criminal trial. He's also the Republican nominee, and this general election is well underway at this point. I mean, remember, we're in April.
200 days.
And people start voting in September. Mm. I mean, we are not that far away. The conventions are right upon us. Whether or not Joe Biden and Donald Trump debate, these are all imminent things now. And he, for the next maybe 6 weeks, is sitting on trial every day. And what is amazing, we have no idea, you and I who have covered so many of these, what the impact of this will be. We just don't know what it will be. We know that people are paying attention. We know that people will have opinions about this and that it may indeed impact voters, but we don't know how yet. And so having this huge X factor when our life is constantly trying to figure out what are all the factors and how do they play in an election is just also an unprecedented.
And you know who else doesn't know? The Biden campaign.
Correct.
Which is, I mean, one of the many reasons that they're kind of staying a little bit, well, a lot away from this. The other, of course, is they don't want to give any more fodder to Donald Trump. False fodder that Biden is somehow involved in this or any of the other trials.
And think about, in addition to Donald Trump and the campaign, just think about what these jurors are experiencing. Americans who have never been in this position before. These 12 that will sit there. No other American has a comparable experience. So imagine what it is for them as well.
Yeah, and it is your basic duty. And we should all, as Americans, thank them, the people who eventually get seated.
Yeah.
And thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. And thank you so much for being here. Please tune in on Sunday to State of the Union. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem will be among my guests. I hope to see you at 9 a.m. Eastern right here on CNN. Thanks for joining Inside Politics. CNN News Central starts after a quick break.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country, Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.